Renegade economists Marilyn Waring, Kate Raworth, and Elena Ostrom, a TUC radio miniseries on how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Marilyn Waring critiques the GDP. Safe drinking water counts for nothing. A pollution-free environment counts for nothing. Even some people, namely women, count for nothing. This according to the United Nations System of National Accounts, the SNA. They set the standard and impose economic and budgetary decisions for almost 200 countries. The SNA produces the GDP, the gross domestic product, that allegedly measures well-being within a country. However, war and catastrophes, deforestation and mining show up as beneficial for the economy under the GDP. Marilyn Waring, former New Zealand MP, now professor, writer, and goat farmer, explained this in her book, Counting for Nothing. She gave a 30-year update at the University of Alberta, Canada, in November of 2016. Marilyn Waring began by honoring the ancestors of the First Nations peoples of New Zealand, where she lives, and Alberta, Canada, where she spoke.
Tēnā koutou, kia ora tātoa katoa. Let me begin by acknowledging the First Nations peoples who have been the successive guardians of the land of Edmonton and the tangata whenua of Aotearoa, New Zealand, where I'm standing. 30 years ago, I was working on the final draft of my book, Counting for Nothing. In this, I analysed how gross domestic product, GDP, derived from something called the United Nations System of National Accounts, imposed an ideology of applied patriarchy on the measurement of economic progress. While I was chairing the Public Expenditure Committee of the New Zealand Parliament, I discovered that this system had a set of rules that excluded women's unpaid work of all kinds, voluntary and community work, unpaid productive work, reproductive work, subsistence work, and household work from these accounts. And these rules also excluded our beautiful ecosystem, except, of course, when natural resources were mined or forested or harvested, deleted, depleted, extracted, exploited. At the same time, this accounting framework seemed to have no debit side. So as long as there were legal or illegal market transactions, for example, trafficking in people or drugs, this was all good for growth. Well, I thought these SNA, well, I'll shorten it to that, these SNA rules sounded very strange. And I asked our Treasury to get a copy of them for me. After a week or so, they advised me that there didn't appear to be either the 1953 or the 1968 version of the rules in New Zealand. Well, in those years, I laboured under a little inferiority complex vis-a-vis Australia, and I said, then please get them for me from Canberra. And soon the reply came back, there's no copy in Australia either. I had no idea I was asking for encyclopedic volumes filling many shelves. If those of you who have seen Terry Nash's movie, Who's Counting, will remember when I get into the library and confront those shelves. But I did know there was something very odd about an international set of rules governing such a central aspect of economic decision-making when nobody needed to read them. Well, I retired from the New Zealand Parliament in interesting circumstances in 1984, and I decided I would go to New York to read these volumes, and I had no idea what lay ahead. I discovered a system which claimed that, quote, primary production and the consumption of their own produce by non-primary producers is of little or no importance, end quote. Well, every woman I knew was classified as a non-primary producer in all or some of her life. Wow, is of little or no importance. So these rules established a boundary of production to determine what was and what was not to be counted in the gross domestic product, the GDP. For what reason? Convenience, the rules explained. Non-primary producers were described as inactive and unoccupied. There were some sectors where non-monetary production was recognised in the 1953 rules. For example, in agriculture, forestry, hunting, mining, quarrying, fishing, rather obviously mostly stereotypical male work. In the 1968 revision, this was expanded to include building and construction, the processing of primary products such as cloth, oil, butter, or furniture. But the revision continued to exclude the carriage of water, weeding of primary productive land crops, which was always women's work, the collection of firework or the manufacture of dung patties for fuel, subsistence crop production, and household activities. What was clear by 1986, as I worked on the book, was that moving the boundary of production was not reflected in the new construction of national income accounts for many reasons. The United Nations System of National Accounts claimed its outstanding use has been in connection with public policy. It also claimed that per capita GDP was the very best indicator of economic welfare. As a parliamentarian, I'd represented a rural constituency in a so-called developed country. Budgetary investment in the agricultural sector was frequently justified on the basis of per capita increases in production. I knew none of this was accurate. Women and children worked very hard in my rural area, and the per capita assumptions attributed only to the man of the household on the farm were seriously overstated, and this data was sadly astray. There was a further change in the boundary of production in 1993. The production boundary was now pushed out to include the carriage of water, crop storage, repairs to buildings if they were made by the owner, wood carrying, weaving baskets and mats, making clay pots and plates, weaving textiles, making furniture, and dressmaking. Subsistence, midwifery, and funeral services were excluded because they could not be resold. The 1993 edition no longer boasted that the SNA and derived data were a crucial indicator of well-being. I could tell my book had been influential, but the work that keeps the world turning was not counted. The main categories of domestic services were excluded. Wherever we've had sanctions, wherever peoples are nomadic, for example, Mongolia, where there are or have been wars, some of which, for example, in Afghanistan, I counted in my prologue 30 years ago, where there have been major natural disasters, such as Nepal's earthquake, or where the resources needed to conduct valid and reliable data collection have never been available in the nation states of most of the Pacific. We do not have GDP data that means anything. Experts from the World Bank, writing in 2015, described the challenge of improving agricultural statistics worldwide as daunting. But when data sets continue to miss smallholder agricultural productivity, we miss a key to reducing poverty and enhancing food security. Well, now we're all in the realm of the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. And Target 8 of the SDGs is, quote, to sustain per capita economic growth in accordance with national circumstances, and in particular, at least 7% gross domestic product growth per annum in the least developed countries. Well, I could flippantly say, but I'm sure I'd be right, If you measured the informal sector, you won't have any difficulty achieving that. But nothing will have changed. You'll just have started seeing all the other half of the population doing their work. The first indicator is annual growth rate of real GDP per capita. The second target is to achieve higher levels of economic productivity. The next indicator is annual growth rate of real GDP per employed person. The commentary notes that, quote, the employment estimates are sensitive to undercoverage of informal or underground activities. The ILO has data on the share of informal employment for only 62 of at least 178 member countries of the ILO. What is all this nonsense about? Why doesn't someone tell the truth about the data that will be used to measure these goals? Recent work in Nepal by ActionAid has shown women working 15 and a half hours a day in paid work, subsistence farming, collecting fuel and water, housework, food preparation, cleaning, and caring for children and adults. In the same activities, men worked 8 hours and spent more time than women sleeping and in self-care. Now let me move to the issue of environment. And if I were writing another edition of the book, I would be using global warming and climate change brought about by carbon emissions and pollutions in many forms as key examples. I'd outline the transnational effects of these, just like the acid rain and ozone layer depletion examples I used 30 years ago. I would survey the floods, typhoons, droughts, and record temperatures recorded all over the planet, the shrinking Arctic ice, the vast ice sheets of the Antarctic breaking apart. The number of environmentally displaced persons worldwide is projected to rise to 150 million by the year 2050. In Tuvalu, a small nation state in the North Pacific with 11,000 inhabitants, most of the 26 square kilometer island nation is less than a meter above sea level. Salt water is contaminating food and scarce fresh water. Tuvalu's chosen plan of action is international migration of the entire nation. The people of Tuvalu and at least two other nations, which will be entirely inundated, Kiribati and the Marshall Islands, do not qualify as refugees under the 1967 United Nations Protocol. When they are forced to leave their home, Tuvaluans will have no remedy against carbon emitters who have removed their fundamental human rights to life, health, food, and self-determination. Climate change raises the question of whether any of the United Nations human rights instruments can address these losses of fundamental rights. When countries sink in their entirety, then not only will people lose their nation and their seat in the United Nations General Assembly, but they will also lose their territorial waters and their 200-mile economic zone, which has been the source of employment and national income. I'm sure the Chinese, who have a recent history of building up and occupying low-lying atolls and islands, will be watching and waiting. And people from the Cataract Islands off Papua New Guinea, where a Canadian mining company is mining gold at a depth of 5 kilometres, just by the way, became some of the first climate change refugees. And there is an ongoing evacuation of 2,500 people to Bougainville. But this is not an easy resettlement. Land on Bougainville is communally owned. As any woman who is the victim of domestic violence and who lives on communally owned land can tell you, when you are beaten or when there is a problem, there is nowhere else to go. Now, growing pollution has been a process of major deterioration in my lifetime, all as a result of this pathological race to record growth in the GDP. Whether it's the rivers and waterways of the New Zealand environment being destroyed by dairy farming, the places in Asia where I have worked in the past, in Myanmar, China, Nepal, Indonesia, Bangladesh, where I no longer go because I cannot breathe. There's the mindless trophy hunting of endangered animals or obnoxious slaughter of rhino for so-called aphrodisiacs or of elephant for ivory, the destruction of forests for logging, the ugly flattening of the habitat of orangutans for oil palm production. There's poaching and illegal fishing. The Pacific Ocean is expected to operate as a sump for the highly radioactive water that continues to pour into the Pacific from Fukushima, with isotopes entering the Pacific food chain. Long-lived industrial pollutants drain into our rivers and run to the sea. Governments lie to their citizens. Corrupt politicians fill their trust accounts with the graft permitting these behaviours, and our planet is going to hell. As I write this address, news bulletins advised that schools in Delhi were closed as the most harmful pollutants, particulate matter 2.5, had reached more than 16 times the safe limit. Pollution contributed to 600,000 deaths per year, more than the total for malaria and HIV/AIDS combined. Meanwhile, inside the environmental accounting framework, the expert group makes it clear that the values present inside the accounts must be for market, not social values. At the same time, we have huge volatility of asset values, where the valuation relies exclusively on the current commodity prices or their expected values in the future. Well, what we need are the descriptions of the physical characteristics of the ecosystem, not some abstracted nonsense for economists to play with. Now, economics, some of you might have noticed, in the last few years has discovered, quote, social capital, end quote. Now, there's actually a huge discomfort for me in using that term, social capital, environmental resources. This language continues this colonizing and propagandistic goal of economics, channeling how people and our ecosystem are abstracted for market equations, as if that's the only source of value. Well, one of the things that social capital needs is people to have relationships. Now, the wondrous world of economics omits to figure out just how these agents of social capital come into the world. The SNA has never managed to cope with reproduction, except when it enters the market. So biological reproduction, pregnancy, giving birth, lactation, motherhood, are all externalities not worthy of mention unless there's a need for intervention by others who are in paid work. If you manage a non-market pregnancy, you're at leisure for 9 months. The best investment in social capital begins with a child breastfed for 6 months, as this makes such a difference for future health, brain development, and attachment. This is a trade-off neither governments nor markets seem to understand. But I checked last night. You can buy, sell, or donate breast milk on eBay. Julie Smith's been working on valuing breast milk and having it included, as it should be, in the Australian GDP. Breast milk totally fits the SNA description of primary production. This has no value in the GDP, but the GDP loves breasts when they're part of the vast international pornography industry. One of the chapters in the book was called The Value of Death, and in the movie it was called Making a Killing. Killing people and preparing to kill people has become much more valuable in the last 30 years. The annual Global Peace Index estimates that conflict, terrorism, and political instability are costing the global economy $13.6 trillion US dollars a year. As if the grotesque amounts of military production already treated as growth were not enough, Ballistic missiles provide an ongoing service, and mothers of teething children are unoccupied. Well, you can work the system to register a weapons-based increase in the GDP, but you can't count breast milk as primary production. Charles Aspin, who's senior administrator at the OECD National Accounts and Financial Statistics Division, still thinks the volume measure of GDP per capita can be used as a surrogate measure of well-being. Here's the point, and let's get it really clear. GDP has never been adequately measured, and it is no different today. It's a complete dog's breakfast, which is unfair to the dog. In 2009, after the global economic crisis, French President Sarkozy set up a commission on the measurement of economic performance and social progress, led by Joseph Stiglitz, Amartya Sen, and Jean-Paul Fitoussi. Its key message, quote, "The time is ripe for our measurement system to shift emphasis from measuring economic production to measuring people's well-being," end quote. Well done, boys, just 20 years late. The latest nightmare is that the same approach is being used for well-being. The good old Central Committee at the OECD is determining what the colonial, monocultural, Western characteristics of well-being are, homogenising them, as I detailed, with respect to pollution, and imposing them on everybody because we need to be compared. As the good old Monty Python line had it, "And now for something completely similar." Now, there is some good stuff happening. In New Zealand, Statistics New Zealand has worked with Tangata Whenua, developed in consultations with Māori communities over 5 years, indicators of Māori well-being. These do not look like the OECD Central Committee's well-being. Māori language, connection to hapū, extended family, and iwi, tribe, engagement in Māori culture, regular visits to ancestral marae. You can find these on the Statistics New Zealand website. And Canada, you have contributed a significant amount to our alternatives for policy making based on reality. I've mentioned that early work with Statistics Canada on the census and in time use. And I remember Statistics Canada also being involved with the Nova Scotian Genuine Progress Indicators, GPI Atlantic. Ron Coleman led these. In my visits to Canada, I began to read of a woman called Maud Barlow, whose decades of work on food and the right to water has been an inspiration. I think she's a Canadian national treasure. Meanwhile, in Alberta at the Pembina Institute, Mark Anielski was constructing the GPI for Alberta. Mark, I still remember the story you told me of waiting to see Paul Martin when he was Minister of Forests, and there was a First Nations man in the outer office too. And he asked you what you were doing, and he drew a circle with his talking stick. And from this, you developed the use of radar diagrams in the four well-being areas in Alberta. That radar diagram approach has been picked up and used again and again. And the great benefit of this approach is their open architecture, where any new indicator can be added as soon as we have a benchmark and another year. Mark, I also honour your work in Nunavut, where a fifth well-being, the spiritual, was added, and your incredible work with the Indigenous peoples of the Boreal Forest. And of course, I'm here, and with you too, to honour Parkland's 20 years of contribution to alternative ways of seeing and being in the world, of working with reality, not theory. Canada, it seems to me you have strong community-based foundations for producing the data and descriptions that enable visibility for all people and for all elements of our ecosystem without the need to abstract all this to dollar values. 78 men have won the Nobel Prize in Economics. In 2009, not surprising really, in that year they couldn't find a man, in 2009, Eleanor Ostrom became the first woman to win. Ostrom's work investigated how communities who had resources in common ownership, forests, lakes, communally owned grazing land, for example, cooperated to share resources sustainably and equitably. The award statement for Eleanor Ostrom begins, "As a political scientist, Eleanor Ostrom's research methods differed from how most economists worked. Usually, they start with an hypothesis, an assumption of reality, which is then put to the test. Eleanor Ostrom started with an actual reality instead." I've spent 30 years turning the UNSNA on its head and shaking it about. It has disintegrated, in fact, if it ever had form. The work of most of the people on the planet that falls inside the production boundary still isn't counted, regardless of the rules. The vast sector ignored outside this boundary means that the central measurement is very far from recording the everyday reality of most people and most economies. It's an appalling misuse of propaganda masquerading as ideology and science. It's a malevolent farce. And the sooner we can be free of its central and controlling influence, the better for all people and the planet. Kia ora.
That was an excerpt of a 50-minute speech by Marilyn Waring. 30 years later, are we still counting for nothing? She's a former New Zealand MP, now professor of public policy at Auckland University, writer and goat farmer. Her book, Counting for Nothing, influenced a generation of social justice, renegade economists. Marilyn Waring gave this lecture on November 18, 2016, at the Parkland Institute at the University of Alberta. Parkland exists to counteract the dominance of the marketplace that led to expanded corporate power, and to preserve the understanding of Canada as a caring and sharing society. That was part two of a TUC Radio miniseries on renegade economics and how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.